Hey, welcome to Andrew Haunt's Rock Revival. That's what you're listening to, and that's what some of you are watching live, and I really appreciate you being here. If you're not familiar with who I am, I'm Andrew Haunt. It's my name up there on the video, and I used to write for Power Play Rock and Metal magazine in the UK, which I did 96 issues with them. I think it was 96 issues I did with them over a period of 9 years, where I interviewed rock stars and reviewed albums and concerts and merchandise and all kinds of things like that, and I really miss it. I spent 9 years doing that and really enjoyed it. I stopped doing that in 2016, and I carried on writing things like comic books and movies and books and things like that, but I've always missed writing about music. So this show, Andrew Haunt's Rock Revival, is all about me geeking out over albums, both classic and obscure. And tonight it is one, while not seen as this particular band's greatest work, it is a classic, and I love it dearly. This album is Fear of the Dark by Iron Maiden. So, I know it divides people. It's no Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, it's no Number of the Beast, but thankfully it's also no X Factor or no Prayer for the Dying. Everyone's got their favourite Maiden albums. My first Maiden album was this one here, Power Slave. And you know, after that, I was hooked. So we've all got our favourites. But for me, Fear of the Dark is a particularly important one. Of course, Iron Maiden are icons. At every step of their career, they've done something iconic, even in the lean years. And this wasn't one of the lean years albums. This was one where they were riding high. So this album was originally released on the 11th of May, 1992. So I'll have been like 13. That's before my 14th birthday. So I'll have been at a very impressionable age. And I remember the first single from it being Be Quick or Be Dead, and loving it to bits. And the metal press at the time, the rock and metal press, saying, oh, it's not where Maiden should be at the moment. And I remember some people not liking it, but I love that song. Be Quick or Be Dead is an absolute anthem. Revisiting it now, it's aged very well. In fact, the whole album, Fear of the Dark, has aged very well. There were three singles from it. So there was Be Quick or Be Dead. There was From Here to Eternity that had a crazy video. I'm not so enamoured of From Here to Eternity, as it has kind of a pub rock, new wave of British heavy metal feel to it. Something my wife always says is that if you just say it all in one, it's very satisfying. So new wave of British heavy metal becomes Nwobbum. Nwobbum. Let's all say that together. One, two, three. Nwobbum. 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 Okay, that's said that far too many times. Now it just sounds like nonsense, but it's nonsense anyway. But anyway, after that, there was the single Wasting Love, which is like a ballady track, a surprising one for Maiden, which kind of disappeared a bit, that single, but I still like that song a lot. But this was the first album in Iron Maiden's career to be produced by Steve Harris. And also the last album to feature producer Martin Birch, who retired after it was made. So that was a sad loss, because Martin Birch was a big part of the Maiden sound and the Maiden story up to that point. And it is kind of a watershed album in many ways, because not long after the tour in support of Fear of the Dark, vocalist Bruce Dickinson famously left and moved on to do his own solo projects. And his solo material is actually really good. He had already started doing solo stuff when he was still in Maiden, like Tattooed Millionaire, which was a great album. But yeah, he moved on. He moved on from Maiden, wanted to try something different for a while, and did it in fine style, I think. There are some great tracks out there. Even now, he's still doing some solo stuff now and again. I do recommend Tyranny of Souls. That is a superb, superb song. So this album, it does have those three singles on it, but one of the most famous songs on it is the title track, Fear of the Dark. And now, that wasn't actually released as a single from this album. It was released as a single from the later live albums. I think it was a real live one. Yeah, I think it was a real live one. And then the other one, the real dead one, was all the older stuff that they were doing at the time. But yeah, it was a big single when the live album came out, and became a firm favourite live, because it is one of those great big Iron Maiden anthems. you know, one of those huge, huge anthems like Hallowed Be Thy Name. It's one of those that you will always want to sing along to, even if you're just singing along to the guitar lines. Or just trying to not to get brained by Yannick Gerst throwing his guitar around, you know, that sort of thing. It's an interesting album because it came out at the height of alternative rock. And as you may be aware, if you are familiar with this show, I'm not the biggest fan of the alternative and grunge scene that followed with the 90s. But hey, it's what it was, what it was. And I loved this album when it came out. It had a different cover, so instead of being by longtime artist Derek Riggs, the artwork was by Melvin Grant, and it was a lot darker, it was a bit weirder, a bit more sinister, and I think it reclaimed some ground that Maiden had lost, where Eddie had become a bit cartoonish, or a bit of like a Freddy Krueger, what's he going to be up to in this one, sort of character. So it was an interesting cover. A surprising cover, and it made for a great t-shirt and a great poster. The track listing on the album is one that it's an interesting one because it does have definite peaks and valleys. It has its great moments and it has its not so great moments. But as with a lot of bands of their status, even a dodgy Iron Maiden song is light years ahead of a lot of bands' main material. So, of course, the album opened up with the single Be Quick or Be Dead. So it takes you straight in there just with Nick and McBrain's drums, getting you right in there into the action, and you're straight away, you know it's a Maiden album. You've got the dual guitars, you've got Steve Harris's bass, you've got Bruce Dickinson's absolutely amazing scream that brings that in. That is followed by From Here to Eternity. Again, I'm not the biggest fan of that song, but it is a decent song. But after Be Quick or Be Dead, it doesn't really have the same punch to these ears. That is followed by Afraid to Shoot Strangers, which is a very powerful song, anti-war song. It's just shy of 7 minutes long, that track, and it is incredible and has a big Maiden chorus and a great big anti-war message in there. And I really enjoy that song and really appreciate that song. That is followed by two tracks that haven't aged so well and aren't that memorable personally in comparison to a lot of other stuff in the Iron Maiden pantheon. The Sphere is the Key and Childhood's End. Those are very good songs. They're great songs, but they are not of the same caliber as a lot of Maiden's other material. However, that is taken back when you get to Wasting Love. It's Wasting Love next after Childhood's End, which is aforementioned. It was a single from the album, and it has a great big sing-along chorus that gets the arms waving and the blood pumping. But it is edging towards what I would call an Iron Maiden ballad, but only in the sense of things like Children of the Damned from Number of the Beast, that sort of track. It's quite mid-paced, and it's great. It's an excellent song. And I don't think that song gets enough love. Then we've got The Fugitive, which is fine. It's fine. That's a bit more of like an early 80s style Maiden track, but it does feel a little bit like a B-side. And we've got Chains of Misery, which, if I remember rightly, has a bit of a boogie riff to it going on at some point. Then there's The Apparition, written by Steve Harris and Yannick Gerz, which was a good track, a pretty standard Maiden track for me. That is followed, however, by Judas Be My Guide, written by Bruce Dickinson and Dave Murray. Dave Murray is a spectacular guitar player, one awesome guitar player, and that track is fantastic. That has got something different going on. Judas Be My Guide, while it was never a huge track for them to play live, and it's never a huge track that a lot of people really appreciate, I think it's glorious. Unfortunately, that is followed by Weekend Warrior, and Weekend Warrior never really gelled for me. I don't really like how the chorus is structured. That's just personal. I know it's all subjective when it comes to music, or indeed any form of creative endeavor. But for me, Weekend Warrior does have a bit of it's a bit of a weak spot on the album. But the album does end with all 7 minutes and 16 seconds of the title track, Fear of the Dark, which, as I say, has become a firm favourite in Maiden live sets. And I don't think, really, the studio version doesn't really have the same power as the live version, but that could be said for a lot of bands and a lot of bands' material. However, there is something a lot more punchy about the live version that came out with a real live one, or indeed the Rock in Rio version is breathtaking. If you look up the Rock in Rio version of Fear of the Dark on YouTube, the title track, it is breathtaking. It's one of the finest performances I've ever seen of it. Now, Iron Maiden's one of those bands where they had some cracking B-sides as well. I remember on the I had the CD singles of Be Quick, Be Dead and From Here to Eternity. Now, what I remember about From Here to Eternity is that it had a poster that folded out with it, which was pretty cool, and it came in a digipack, and those were still kind of new at the time, so that was pretty good. But the one that I really remember was on Be Quick or Be Dead. There was a version of the Montrose song, Space Station Number 5, the old Montrose song written by Ronnie Montrose and Sammy Hagar. And that was a great track. That was a great track. But then we went on to a lot of silence for a while. There was silence after Space Station Number 5 ended. If you look up the track, it's listed as being 11 minutes 57 long. The actual song is only about 3 minutes long. But after all this silence, you start to hear some acoustic guitars and some muttering. And that turns into several minutes of Bruce Dickinson doing like a spoken word, stream of consciousness, stand-up routine. It's fantastic. I loved it. It's really funny. Especially when he starts talking about the different artists doing the picture of Eddie for the cover having a tattoo on his willy. A tattoo on his bloody willy. I remember him saying that very clearly because it just made me howl with laughter. And do check that out. Do check out the B-sides. The other B-sides that came out around then were collected together on a bonus disc in 95. Nodding Donkey Blues, Space Station Number 5, Roll Over Vic Vella, I Can't See My Feelings, which is a budgie cover, No Prayer for the Dying Live, Public Enema Number 1 Live, and Huxing You Live. And you know, the B-sides are fun. They're a lot of fun, and especially on the live tracks, you can hear how much fun Maiden still had on stage with it. But this was to be the last album that Bruce Dickinson did with the band for a long, long time. He was replaced by, of course, Blaze Bayley, who is the singer in Wolfsbane. And that was an interesting era. It brought fans albums The X Factor and Virtual 11. It saw Iron Maiden move down to smaller venues for a while. And it was in one of those smaller venues that I had the first time I had the experience of seeing them live. So that was at Sheffield City Hall in 98. And that was in support of Virtual 11, which was the album they'd had out at the time. And in all honesty, I'm not a big fan of Virtual 11. I like The X Factor, though. The X Factor is a pretty solid album, especially with things like the... oh, God, Man on the Edge, the first single from that, was really strong. That was a proper classic Maiden anthem, that. Virtual 11 didn't really grab me. You know, there was the football theme going on. I'm not a big football fan. Well, I'm not a football fan. Let me correct that. But it was on that tour that I saw them, and I had an incredible experience there. I went with an old mate of mine, Steve, who I was in bands with when I was a teenager. But in 98, we went and saw Iron Maiden. Who was opening up? It was someone on Steve Harris's record label. It was Dirty Deeds opening up, I think, that was on Steve Harris's Sanctuary Records, I think it was. But they were good. They were a solid opener. But then Maiden came on, and of course it was with Blaze Bayley, and this is before they got Adrian Smith back in the band. So it was Blaze Bayley on vocals, Yannick Gers and Dave Murray on guitar, Steve Harris on bass, and Nico McBrain on drums. So it was like a year or so before they came back with Brave New World, which I loved, and, you know, formed what I think is the definitive version of Iron Maiden that has Adrian Smith on guitar as well. So three guitars and Bruce Dickinson on vocals. To me, that is the definitive. I think they've got so much power behind them with three guitars, and, you know, it makes sense for them to have three because then there can always be a rhythm under all the harmonized leads and that sort of thing. It's an interesting mix with three guitars, but this was before that. So Maiden were playing the Sheffield City Hall, It was a smaller venue. They weren't playing arenas at that point. So I was thinking, oh, it's going to be a scaled back show. It's not going to be like too over the top. However, that was wrong. It was absolutely packed. The crowd was wild. The crowd was completely up for it. Blaze Bayley was on excellent form. It was a really solid gig. They played all the favourites. I got to be encased in Eddie's hand. So there wasn't an Eddie walking around the stage, but what there was a gigantic Virtual 11 inflatable Eddie. So the head would inflate from the back of the stage. And then around the front of the PA, inflatable Eddie hands would come out. So Eddie actually came out and grabbed me and my buddy Steve, and that was so fun. But one of my clearest memories from the gig itself that night was actually when an overzealous security guard tried to stop me and Steve and all the people around us who were directly in front of Steve Harris from jumping around. And it's like, we were at the front at an Iron Maiden concert. We're going to jump around. We're going to jump around. We're going to go crazy. We're going to scream our heads off to every war-related lyric that we know. We're going to sing along to all the guitar lines. We're going to say ridiculous things to Nicko McBrain because that's what Nicko McBrain is generally for, I think. But this security guard had different ideas and started holding us down. So he actually reached out and shoved his forearm over our shoulders and would stop us jumping up and down and getting too crazy. It's not, we're not like we're going to stage dive. Maiden gigs is not really the place where you get stage divers. That doesn't really happen to them. But this guy thought we were going to get wild and leery and go overboard and start smashing the place up or something. I don't know. But Steve Harris saw this. And from the stage, in the middle of a song, knelt down in front of us, literally about 6 inches away from my face, grabbed hold of the security guard in a semi-headlock and screamed into his ear, "Don't you ever mess with my audience." And he buggered off. And of course, all the crowd around us just started yelling, "Nice one, Harry! Nice one, son," as you do when Steve Harris is there. I mean, it's Steve Harris, it's Maiden. You know, even in their lowest points, they are Maiden through and through. And they've never been anything but Maiden. And they've always been there for the fans that have stuck by them. And they've always been there for themselves. They've never jumped the shark. Even when they've not put out stuff that's really been to my cup of tea, like this is my cup of tea, that's like Virtual 11. You know, not everything's been to my taste. And Final Frontier wasn't really to my taste later on, but that's a different story. But we always got the impression they were there for us. And in that moment, they really were there for us. And that was lovely. The other thing I remember about that night was that after the show, as was customary at the time in the 90s, whenever I would go to a show, especially at the Sheffield City Hall, I would go around the back of the place and try and meet some of the acts. Now, previously, highlights were doing that. I met David Lee Roth, like, the week I left school, on a tour he did, which was spectacular. Nicest man you could imagine. I think he was nice because he was so drunk, his tour manager had to help his hand sign my program. That was a great night. I met Skid Row outside there and wound up in the November 1995 issue of Metal Hammer. If you have an archive of those magazines, if you look for a gold cover, November 1995, gold cover Metal Hammer with Dave Mustaine on the front, there was a Skid Row live feature in there that recounts the entire experience of them going to Sheffield. And there's a picture of half of my face behind Sebastian Bach. So if this, it's like, I'm going like that. So you'll, if you, who the hell's going to look that up other than me? I mean, I've still got a copy, but no one else is going to be bothered enough to look that up. But if you ever do, that's, I'm in there with Sebastian Bach. And I get a mention in that write-up where I actually started the Baz 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 cry. But anyway, we're talking about Maiden. So yes, I would go around the back of these places and I would meet artists. Even met Steve Vai, Joe Satriani there once. But when I met Maiden, by the time we'd gone round to the back, once we'd gone out of the venue, we found that Dave Murray and Yannick Gers had already headed off to the hotel. They'd literally got straight in a taxi and gone to the hotel as they came off stage. And I get that. They were knackered. They'd had a long gig. They were be exhausted, maybe not want to meet people at that particular point. And I get that. Not everyone wants to meet people. That's fine. That's cool. But we met three of them at that time. We met Blaze Bailey, who seemed oddly quiet. So this was 1998. And I remember Blaze Bailey seeming a bit quiet and a bit withdrawn. Now, that could have been to do with him being knackered after a show and putting on a really good show. Of course, it doesn't have the range of Bruce Dickinson, but he had an incredible night that night. A really good vocal performance that night. It was excellent. And he handled stuff very, very well, I must say. He was very friendly. He was very nice to us, and we signed our autographs and, you know, shook hands and that. But then he went on his way, and he seemed a bit quiet. But I always wondered whether he knew, whether it had already been said that, you know, Bruce would be back the next year for the next album. I don't know. But he just seemed a bit quiet that night, and that was a shame. But he was really nice. But then Nico McBrain came out. Once Blaze had gone into a tour bus or to a taxi, Nico McBrain came out and just stuck his head outside of the stage door. And they're very famous stage doors, those around the back of the Sheffield City Hall. They've had the Beatles there and Hendrix and all kinds of people there. But, Nico McBrain stuck his head out, looked at the remainder of the people that were still waiting. I think, I don't know, maybe about a dozen of us, maybe 12 to 15 people left. Originally, there'd been about 50, but a lot of people had left because we waited quite a while. But Nico McBrain stuck his head out, looked at us and went, "Bloody hell, it's raining. Here, come with me." And he took us in through the stage doors. He took us inside into the Sheffield City Hall, through the stage doors, said to all security, "These are with me, ignore, it's all right. These come with me, they're fine." And sat us in the auditorium where we'd just seen the gig. Says, "You all come and sit down and we'll have a chat." So we all had a chat with Nico McBrain, and he was really, really cool. And then he brought us beers. Right, this is awesome. Rockstar turned up with cans of beer from the rider and handed them out. And that was really nice of him. It was just a really lovely gesture. And he really felt, we really got the notion that he wanted to hang out with us, that he wanted to say hello. It wasn't through a sense of obligation. And he came across very naturally and very nice as a genuine, genuine guy. And that was so nice. And he signed the posters we'd got and the CD covers, shook hands. This is before smartphones, so there weren't any photos of that, unfortunately. But he hung out for a good while. And then he called Steve over. And Steve Harris came over. And this was incredible to me. This is Steve Harris that wrote The Trooper and things like that. So Steve Harris came over and had a chat with us. And Steve doesn't have the massive extroverted personality of Nico McBrain. He's a bit more calm and considered and really friendly and really sweet guy. And we were talking to Steve Harris. We got his autographs and whatnot. And I had one of my proudest moments, I got to give Steve Harris a demo tape I'd made. This was back when I was making four-track demos on an old Tascam Porter studio I'd borrowed from my dad. I was making these in my bedroom, so I was playing guitar. I was setting the drums off with my toe. All my drums were on my keyboard. And for bass, because I didn't have a bass, I just turned the bass up on track 4, which would be an acoustic guitar, just with the bass turned right up, so it sounded a bit like a bass, but was in standard tuning. You know, the things you do when you're a teenager. I was impressed with my own ingenuity when listening back to those things, but none of those recordings were particularly good. But I did get to give Steve Harris a demo of mine, and he looked it over. And I told him what it was, and he was, "Oh, cool, thanks, I'll give that a listen," and put it in his back pocket. Now, I've never been under any illusions that he ever heard anything I'd done on that tape. I would completely say that as soon as he'd said goodbye to us, that tape went in the bin, and I'm absolutely fine with that because I got to give Steve Harris my demo, and I'm absolutely fine with that. My obsession with Iron Maiden got to the point where at one point when I was in a band at college, I sent them a letter saying, "My band is playing our first show soon. Would Iron Maiden like to come and support us it could be a bit of a talking point. And, oh, Jesus, I think back to the things I did as a teenager, and I cringe. There was one incident where I rang from my bedroom in Sheffield. I called New Line Cinema and tried to get a film made. But yeah, I sent a letter back in the days of letters to Iron Maiden, and I got a response from their fan club manager. That was incredible. So, I've passed your letter on to the boys in the studio. Do bear in mind that if you do get a response, it may be in the negative. But I got a letter back from Iron Maiden's fan club on headed Iron Maiden notepaper, acknowledging that they'd sent the letter on to the guys in the studio. And they've always been that sort of band where they become part of you. It's a weird one, Iron Maiden, because they come across so personable and so approachable and so normal. You know, they're not pretty boy rock stars. They're legends, but they're not pretty boys. No offense, Iron Maiden. Much love to you. But they come across as so pleasant and so nice that you sort of welcome them into your life. So as soon as you see them, you just want to be buddies with them. That was my experience with Iron Maiden. That night, they did play some tracks from Fear the Dark, and I loved it. I saw them again later on with Lauren Harris and Trivium opening when they did the A Matter of Life and Death album. And they played the entire album from start to finish, all 74 minutes of it, and then did a greatest hits set. That was an amazing night. I know a lot of people weren't that pleased when they realised they were playing the entire album, because a lot of people were wanting to see a greatest hits package, but I loved it. It was really nice and fresh to see something interesting and new, and not just the same old stuff. And then, of course, they played Fear of the Dark and things like that to end the show, and it was just marvellous. But Fear of the Dark is something that's always stuck with me. And I remember there is a book I was writing called Metalhead, my rock and metal memoir. And that will arrive at some point, but I have to take some stuff out of it and rework some stuff. That does exist, but I've just never got it to a point where I could put it out. But I will, because that is a full memoir of all my rock and metal stories over the years. In that, I mention something that came up on GMTV, the old morning TV show, where there was a review of that week's new singles. And one of the singles that week was the live version of Fear of the Dark, from a real live one, from the Iron Maiden live album. And the lady reviewing it was really dismissive. In fact, all the presenters were very dismissive of it. You know, they played like a 5-second clip of Fear of the Dark, and then they're like, oh, there's Iron Maiden, you know, doing the heavy metal thing. Oh, is it amazing that people still do that sort of thing? And something they said there really stuck with me, because it kind of burned into my soul when I heard it. And that was when this lady said, well, this song, it sounds like an ending, you know, it sounds like the end of this sort of music. I don't think we'll hear anything like this anymore. But yeah, they said that Fear of the Dark sounded like the end of metal and the end of Iron Maiden. That was in 1993. So to those naysayers that say this stuff is a phase, that it will pass eventually, I raise a hearty two fingers towards you, my friend. Because this has stuck around. That song has stuck around. And it's only become more and more popular. It's way more popular now as a live staple than it was as a title track. You know, it just has a unique power all of its own, and it covers all of the Iron Maiden bases. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So that is me talking about Fear of the Dark by Iron Maiden and going off on a tangent about other Maiden-related things. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I do fully intend to get some more rock revival going on. I hope you've enjoyed the live experience of seeing it live as well. I do greatly appreciate you being here. And I just appreciate people letting me make stuff, because it's fun. And, it keeps me off the streets. It keeps me relatively sane. I'm very grateful for that. If you haven't already, please do go and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Planet Hex, where I talk about all kinds of pop culture stuff and the writing life, and my new channel on there called That Retro Life, which is all about the retro life that so many of us lead, and the stuff we seek out to connect us to what made us who we are. But this is Andrew Watts Rock Revival, and this has been one of my favourite albums ever, and I do really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. I love Maiden. I always will like Maiden. I don't always get along with their albums. Like Book of Souls took a long time to grow on me. And, you know, it's one of those great things, though, where you can come back to a band years later and rediscover them all over again. And that's something I've done many times with Maiden. They've always been there for me. And as long as they're going, I'll always be there for them as well. I'm Andrew Horn. Thank you very much for watching this episode, or listening to this episode, of my Rock Revival. Bye-bye.